up, and you're tuning into our super summer programming. I'm Hallelujah.
And I'm Stella. And together, we'll be highlighting the queer community, environmental issues, and upcoming local events.
Stay tuned for interviews, discussion, and music from our collections.
Welcome, welcome. This is CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby is located on the ancestral and stolen territories of the Halkamelem and Squamish-speaking peoples, the lands that they have cared for since time immemorial. Today I'm here with Michelle and Matt from the Climate Equity Action and Resilience Project, also known as CLEAR. So welcome to CJSF's airwaves. We're so glad to have you. Before we get too deep into the interview, can you all just introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Michelle is pointing at me, so I will go first. Yeah, my name is Matt Hume. My pronouns are he, him. My background is as an educator. Once upon a time in another life, I was a public school teacher in Alberta, as well as where I come from, and here in British Columbia in Delta. And I've worked at the University of British Columbia at the Learning Exchange, which is located in Vancouver's downtown Eastside communities for just about 10 years now. I came back to do my master's degree, came across the Learning Exchange, which is a community university hub, and absolutely fell in love with the place. And that's how I got connected to CLEAR and why I get to work with Michelle and my wonderful colleagues working on climate justice within the downtown Eastside communities.
Thanks, Matt. Yes, my name is Michelle Hack-Hepburn. So I work at the Sustainability Hub at the University of British Columbia. And we, along with the Learning Exchange, really brought together a group of different nonprofits and community organizations working in the downtown East Side for the CLEAR project that you wanted to hear about today.
Yes, lovely. And I just wanted to start at the beginning, first of all, of like what led to the creation of the CLEAR project.
Yeah, it's an easy but sad response, which was the heat domes of 2021. It's interesting to kind of reflect back. Michelle kind of mentioned we did a wonderful job of kind of collecting both campus and community organizations. This was all in response to the heat dome. And so the Learning Exchange itself, we have not traditionally considered ourselves a sustainability-focused office. We do literacy-based programs, language literacy, digital literacy for community members. We hadn't really done a lot of work in sustainability before 2021, but really witnessing the disproportionate effect that the heat domes had on unhoused populations, on folks who did not have access to cooling infrastructure, AC, really seeing the negative impact it had on the downtown Eastside communities, we could no longer say, hey, we don't do sustainability. It's not in our wheelhouse. And so we ended up connecting with the wonderful folks at the Sustainability Hub who do sustainability and do a wonderful job in promoting it both on campus and out in community, knowing that they were experts in really what does sustainability look like, how do we merge academic and community-based interests to do this. We had the connections with organizations who, again, themselves may not necessarily consider themselves traditional sustainability organizations. Partners like Working Gear, who are a wonderful CLEAR partner, they take donations of work clothing from, for example, film and television shoots who wrap up here in Vancouver. They have a lot of like work-appropriate clothing that would either just go to the landfill or go somewhere else. They take donations and repurpose those for redistribution at pop-up events in the downtown Eastside community. They really consider themselves employment training and employment preparedness. They do some peer advocacy, but they don't necessarily brand themselves a sustainability organization, but when we really think about it, how much waste are they diverting from landfills every year just by taking these clothing donations? And so a really unique aspect is that we pivoted towards really focusing on sustainability research, sustainability network building with the support of the hub, but we really got this network of organizations who now really are leading into sustainability as how can we embed this into our practice? How can we develop funding models that are really supporting sustainability work along all the other amazing things we already do in with community? And so it's a group of people who came together saying we can no longer pretend like we should not or do not do sustainability in community. We need to pivot. We need to find resources. We need to help support the most vulnerable populations, the folks that we work with every day when it does get really hot or conversely really cold out there. How can we really make sure that we can't just say this is not in our scope anymore because it needs to be in our scope. And that was kind of the origins of the project. It started as a two, three-year pilot with some funding from the McConnell Corporation. They really helped us kick off the very early days of working with peers in the community who were doing sustainability-related work and really wanted to advocate to the city, to funders, to really better support the initiatives that were happening in the community. And that three-year pilot is now well past the 3 years. We're still going. It is an ongoing initiative that has grown and evolved, and we've added new partners along the way. We've had new projects that are coming down the pipe that I'm sure we'll talk about over the next hour. And Michelle came and joined a little bit into the process. What were your experiences when you joined CLEAR?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, CLEAR started really as an initiative that was administered as a joint project from the Learning Exchange and the Sustainability Hub. And really, it was we were able to get started through with support from the McConnell Foundation. And it was really a collaboration that came from the previous senior director of the Sustainability Hub, as well as the current director of the Learning Exchange, who were able to start to bring these people together and start those conversations. And so I came in to help lead some of the administration and the logistics, and I saw and found a group of different organizations, different people working at these different organizations. So at the time, there was Embers Eastside Works, UGM, the Recycling Alternative, Working Gear, as well as Learning Exchange and the Sustainability Hub, all at a table working on different projects, bringing people together, taking action to find those immediate actions that you can take to actually start to address some of the impacts from climate change in the downtown Eastside communities, as well as coming together to strategize about how to address some of the larger systemic issues and think about that long-term strategy of impacting policies and understanding the kinds of research questions and the kinds of applied research work that would need to be done to be able to support those long-term goals. So that's what I saw when I came in. And we were able to actually achieve quite a lot in those first initial years of CLEAR. And as Matt mentioned, we have since added new partners. We've been working to expand the group of organizations that we've been working with. And we can share more about the kinds of activities and the kinds of applied research projects that happened, depending on what you would like to.
Yeah, definitely. We will probably get into that. Yeah, it has definitely been getting more and more severe over time, climate change and global warming. I've heard to it being referred even as like global boiling. And yeah, like it is great to acknowledge like we need to have these immediate like steps to address the climate crisis, but also systemic issues. So I was wondering, what kind of work does CLEAR do in and around the downtown Eastside with both like thinking about systemic things and also the more immediate issues?
So we've done a lot in the early years through Embers Eastside Works, who unfortunately is no longer operating as an organization, but they were able to hire peer workers. So people who live in the downtown Eastside, who they decided and they identified what they needed to do, which was to have these pop-up heating and cooling pop-ups. And so with their support, with also some of the funding and the logistical support that CLEAR was able to provide, they held up these pop-up heating and cooling stations to distribute some of the materials that would actually help people who were unhoused or precariously housed in the most extreme weather over the last couple of years. And then in terms of, and we can talk more, there's some more to share with what kinds of materials that I'm sure Matt will speak to. And then in terms of those long-term strategies, we've also supported, especially through the program called Sustainability Scholars, which is run out of the Sustainability Hub, which is a paid program that provides work opportunities, work integrated learning opportunities for graduate students. And so we were able to have graduate students work with some of our CLEAR community partners to do work to advance the climate resilience work in the downtown Eastside. And a big one that's really important is Unhoused Under Pressure, which is a report that was done with UGM. And it basically shows how the climate crisis is exacerbating these other issues and layered on top of all of the other things that people are struggling with and folks are really struggling with in the downtown east side. So issues like mental health, when your body can't identify its own temperature, then you cannot identify yourself that you need help when it's 35 degrees in your apartment. And then so you can't help get the help that you need. You can't cool yourself down because you don't even realize that you're overheating. So I really being able to lay those out and show how the intersections really come out. Another postdoc who is working at UBC has also done some work with VANDU and with EDGE, so the East Side Illicit Drinkers.
For education, yeah.
Yeah, for education, they have really advocated, and that's so EDGE researchers who are residents who belong to EDGE in collaboration with this postdoc whose name is Amber Grant working at UBC. They really also identify that they, as illicit drinkers who are consuming alcohol in public spaces, when cops pour that out, their body has a harder time to deal with extreme heat. And when it is so hot outside and they need to consume to be able to avoid DTs, which are withdrawal symptoms from alcohol and really one of the only potentially fatal symptoms of withdrawal from a substance, they would then go to a shaded structure and they really experience the police presence of preventing them from being able to consume alcohol in those spaces. And so they are, as well as being more exposed to dehydration because of drinking, they really need to advocate for alternative solutions of how they're experiencing the climate crisis. And so that's one of the things that CLEAR, through partnerships with graduate students and researchers at universities, are really trying to show some research and data to support some of those advocacy issues that people are raising.
Yeah, and I think Michelle touched on a really important overarching theme of CLEAR, which is we do want to support all of the on-the-ground efforts with research, but research is nothing without action, and we continuously get the feedback. The downtown east side are over-researched communities. They don't have a lot of capacity to contribute to new research initiatives. Folks need to be compensated properly. There's a lot of ethical considerations that need to go into research, and so we're not there to add to the bulk of research without action that's done in and with communities, let alone the downtown east side communities. I think really emphasizing, are there community groups who are already doing some action, like the Side Drinkers group, who are already, they're creating heat diaries on the really hot days. What techniques are they using to stay cool? If there is a dearth of shade and tree canopy in the downtown east side, which we absolutely know there is, it is one of the biggest issues facing the communities, that there is almost no tree canopy, no shade creating structures, not a lot of green spaces for folks. And so hearing directly from those with the lived and living experience of facing the day-to-day of when it does get really hot, how can we kind of translate that to inform climate approaches, climate policy? And if there is research, and there is a dearth of research specifically about climate justice as it relates to the downtown east side communities, there has been some done in the intersection, and Michelle articulated the Unhoused Under Pressure report, which really does look at the intersection between underhousing and how does that really affect folks when it does get really, really hot out. I think, you know, identifying whether we're working with sustainability scholars, UBC students, whether we're working with more advanced researchers. Another example is Dr. Liv Yoon, Rafi Arifin, and their team through the UBC Center for Climate Justice. They, not related to CLEAR, they were doing this work long before CLEAR even assembled, but they were really looking at something called the right to cool. And for me, this is a really wonderful example of how tangible research can be turned into tangible action. They were really advocating the idea that cooling should be approached as a human right. Heating is treated as a human right. There are minimum standards standards for, you know, if your apartment or your SRO is not being heated, it is up to the landlord to provide heating as a basic human decency. There was no maximum heat limit for apartments, condos, or SROs at all in BC. It could get as hot as you needed, and your landlord had no duty to provide air conditioning or mechanical cooling to get that down. Liv Yoon and her team were really advocating, saying this should be approached from a human rights framework. We can't just say should we or shouldn't we. We need to declare the right to cool as a fundamental human right. We need to look at very outdated policies, whether it's city, whether it's province, that are restricting folks from accessing cooling infrastructure, whether that's you're not allowed to have AC in your unit, your landlord is not accommodating that. There are no cool spaces in your building. There are a lot of really, like, a lot of barriers towards just folks being able to cool themselves. And I think sometimes it's easy to say, oh, well, there's like cooling centers. Go to the library, go to, you know, one of the shelters is offering cooling. A lot of folks have mobility issues. They are living in SROs where maybe the elevator isn't working that day. They can't always just mobilize to a cooling space. Often they need cooling resources right at home. And so I think Liv Yoon and their wonderful research, they worked very closely with First United, who we are now working with via the CLEAR project. And they've used some of their housing sites to start opening cool rooms that on the hottest days of the summer, folks can go from within that building. They don't have to travel to a cooling center. They're able to access a cooling space just within their building. I know they're working with SFU and some other folks to just really create pools of resources for folks to get cool in communities when it does get really hot as well. And so I think that, and I want to give props to my wonderful, my colleague, Michelle, who is a New West resident. New West was the first district in all of BC who adopted a kind of a right to cool framework. They got ahead of Vancouver, and they did a wonderful job in Vancouver. Recently actually did pass through City Council, the right to cool movement, and props to City Council for getting that through. That does identify that landlords can be punished for not providing cooling solutions for folks who are renting spaces that are not being mechanically cooled, that are getting really, really hot. And so it was a step in the right direction. I think we don't want to do any research just for the sake of doing research. This is a learning exchange model. I hope this is a UBC and SFU model. Research is really nothing without tangible action. And so we really want to emphasize, if there is climate research that is filling that dearth, we do need climate research to be done in with the Downtown East Side and its residents, the peer researchers there, the folks who are living this on the day-to-day. But it really needs to lead to tangible actions, or we're all wasting everybody's time. And really, for the community to take UBC CLEAR seriously, we need to demonstrate that it's not just talk, that we're not just rallying researchers and folks to just continuously talk about how bad things are and how hot things are. What are we actually doing about it? And seeing the right to cool as an example of, we actually saw some tangible action that came from directly within the Downtown East Side, from folks mobilizing and actually taking the theory, the research, how can we apply this to housing sites in the community, and then bringing it to City Council and saying, this model works, can we do more of this? I think that that's really what CLEAR wants to emphasize. And again, it was not a CLEAR initiated thing. We worked with Liv Yoon to we had a right to cool forum last year. It was the Downtown East Side Beat the Heat Forum. It was in November, so after the really, really hot days of the summer. But we really wanted to get community members, organizers, funders, researchers all together to talk about how can we turn the theory into action. And that was where Liv Yoon did a wonderful presentation about their work. And just a few months later, we actually saw that passed. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I would just add, that is what CLEAR has always tried to do. So CLEAR is really a model about convening people and bringing people together. And it's about connecting some of those university resources, which really includes some excellent high quality researchers, to have community organizations who are often have, especially nonprofits, they have extreme limitations both in time. These are folks and organizations that are working very hard to meet the needs of the Downtown East Side based organizations are meeting the needs of folks in the Downtown East Side. And by adding to that capacity to be able to get people into the same room and to have these conversations and make that connection between research that is already happening to the organizations who are also impacted and need some of those research to advance their own advocacy initiatives. That's really what CLEAR has been from the beginning. Yeah. And that's what we continue to try and do, and make those connections between these different groups of people who are working towards the same goals.
Yeah. That's great. I know both of you mentioned the Unhoused Under Pressure report, and I want to talk a little bit about that. I was wondering if y'all would be able to break down the host of systemic factors that have led residents of the downtown East Side to be one of the communities in Vancouver that's most impacted by the climate crisis.
There are so many.
I know. We don't need to, I know it's a big one. We don't need to cover all of them because that would be, you know, a big segment. But
well, Matt did mention it's the lack of tree canopy. So it's one of the communities in Vancouver that have the least amount of tree cover. And research shows, and I mean, just your experience shows, if you go for a walk in a place where there is no shade from mature trees versus a place where there is shade from mature trees, you can, your body can feel the temperature difference. And so by not having shade, it is exacerbating this like urban heat island effect, which is that, you know, cement and asphalt get really hot. So that's one example. Matt, do you want to?
Yeah. It's a bunch of impacts all kind of coming together, right? The lack of tree canopy means that there's no kind of escape from the heat. You can't really leave your residence or wherever you are to go find shade somewhere. There's also like SROs and other, you know, housing sites that are not able to cool themselves. Maybe it's not even just a landlord who says, no, you can't have AC. Some of them have windows that don't even properly open to create ventilation, let alone having air conditioning in there. Folks with chronic conditions, folks who have been using substances are already sometimes in a state of dehydration or on Michelle did a great job speaking about how folks are sometimes unable to self-regulate. And so having things like an indoor thermometer, some folks who check on each other during those really hot times, these are some of the supports that the community has kind of developed on their own to kind of cope with this. But it's the intersection of a lot of different factors, under housing and poor quality housing with really poor ventilation. It gets really, really hot, dearth of green space, and then, you know, an overrepresentation of folks who do have struggles with their mental or physical health, who don't have the same coping strategies to deal with heat that, you know, folks outside of the community do. When we kind of create a perfect storm of all of those things together, right? They not only do they intersect, but they start to exacerbate one another. And so, you know, somebody who, like Edge does a wonderful job of really advocating for this. So a good example is in the early days of CLEAR, the city of Vancouver is doing a wonderful job putting together cooling kits that had different cooling supplies. You could buy them at a reduced cost. They were provided to different community organizations and the Learning Exchange, others would distribute these cooling kits. One of the challenges with the kits were wonderful in the city. I really want to applaud the city and the folks who really worked on those kits for putting them together. One of the challenges that we had in distributing the kits is that they kind of came as a package deal, and they were really sometimes meant for indoor cooling. They didn't have a lot of resources that were meant for quick cooling or temporary cooling. The Edge folks that Michelle mentioned, part of their study identified, hey, if we're outside, we don't have access to shade or cooling space, and we've been consuming alcohol, I'm already in a state of dehydration compared to the average person because I've been using or because I've been out in the sun. And so just a bottle of water may not be enough to adequately hydrate me if I'm feeling thirsty or if I'm entering a state of dehydration. The city's cooling kits came with a reusable water bottle, which was great, but Edge advocated saying, hey, electrolytes. Electrolyte powder, the same thing that you find in your Gatorade or those sports drinks, this is much more quickly hydrating and could be used in an emergency situation. They said, this is something that we would like to see added to cooling kits specific to the downtown Eastside context. And this is, I think, a lot of what the work that CLEAR has evolved to do as well, is kind of saying, it's great that some of these resources out there, but we need to adapt them to the downtown East Side. They're kind of general use right now, and it's wonderful that they exist and they've benefited a lot of people, but we're not thinking about the most vulnerable populations when we're creating things like infographics or communication materials, and we're creating these cooling kits. They're trying to meet a very broad demand and a very broad audience, and creating those, again, very well-meaning, but sometimes things like electrolytes, like reflective paper for windows of an SRO that you could use to reflect the sunlight out. The average person may not need that because they have AC, but this would work for somebody who can't have mechanical cooling in their unit. These are some of the solutions that we've come up with that either come from really community-involved research or folks just sharing their own lived experience saying, hey, it's nice that this cooling infographic that you know, the province put out says that on a hot day, if I'm feeling warm, I can go window shopping to cool myself down. This is a real example. There are no malls in the downtown side providing bad, like, it's kind of, you know, a little condescending to the community, some of these solutions that are proposed out there. And so I think really making sure that as these resources are generated, as folks do start taking climate change and climate justice seriously, we're making sure that they they are considering the diverse needs of folks who may not have the same accesses or resources that the average person may have. We all need to stay cool. It is a human issue. Climate justice is affecting all of us, but we really need to make sure when we're trying to communicate or create these resources, we're thinking about those who are really impacted because of their lived and living experience, because of their housing situation, because of their physical or mental health. And a lot of the work that we're doing, as it evolves, it's really advocating for more supplies and resources that are just curated to the downtown east side and the needs of the residents there.
Yeah, and talking about a little more about the urban heat island that you mentioned, I was personally curious if you think that it might be just like a coincidence that that is what's going on in the downtown east side specifically, or if it's an act of neglect or ignorance by, you know, like urban planners or the city.
So this is a challenging question to answer.
Yeah.
In part because there are historical and ongoing systemic issues that have led to some of the reasons why there is less canopy cover. And I don't want to discount those. Mm-hmm. There are also additional challenges of being able to increase canopy cover, especially in a changing climate. Mm-hmm. So urban trees in particular it is difficult to establish urban trees. And what I think needs to happen in part is to be able to invest in community-led solutions. So, and that's also what we've been hearing from community partners in the downtown east side through CLEAR, is when there are community members who are empowered to find and create the kinds of solutions that they would need to, for example, plant more trees and ensure that they grow. It is a different kind of investment than just an engineering team or a parks and rec team from the city to go and plant a tree. And in times of austerity, and also in times of short cycles, it is harder to always remember the value of these long-term community building and relationship building investments, which is really building up a community and giving them the tools that they need to be able to address and reduce those impacts like the urban heat island. There are also strategies that are not necessarily trees of creating shade structures, and they can offer an immediate response and create shade in the downtown east side. And then you start to encounter some different regulations that can sometimes make it more difficult to be able to adapt quickly to the needs of communities all over Vancouver, not just the downtown east side. But so that's why we need to be able to create these collaborations and enable more collaborations to identify what those barriers are and think about how we can move past them. Why is it challenging to be able to put up a shade structure over a sidewalk? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Michelle, there's kind of two very specific examples I can give of kind of what Michelle's talking about here. So one of the Sustainability Scholar reports that came out, it was by a Sustainability Scholar named Radhika Singh, and it was called DIY, Do-It-Yourself Passive Cooling Techniques for Residents of the Downtown East Side, really looking at housed folks but who didn't have access to mechanical cooling. And she really looked at, like, what are some practical solutions that folks could, like, you know, without applying for a massive funding pool or the government coming in to rescue me, what can I just do in my own space to cool it down? One of the recommendations that came out was actually if you paint the roofs of there's a lot of like tar colored or very dark colored roofs buildings in Vancouver, if you've ever seen it from above. If you paint the roof of a structure white, it lowers the indoor temperature by an average of about, like, I think it's 3 to 4 degrees.
Oh, wow.
Something just simple like that. Like, we all learn about, like, color refraction theory in, like, elementary school, right? It actually, yeah, depending on what color you paint the roof of a building can change. So this actually got some uptick. Some folks were looking at it at Housing BC and the city. One of the engineers, it's always an engineering issue, which was like, like, oh, but if you paint the roof white, it might void the warranty. Like, it's it was a kind of like a very functional, like, we could try that, but it's going to void all of the roofing warranty and all the work that was done. And so there's always kind of like a barrier towards doing it. Same thing, there was a few different places in the world have gotten, there was one specific, I can't remember where out of South America it was from, but there was a group that was knitting literal canopy structures and hanging them between buildings. It was very artistic, very colorful. It was a beautiful way of addressing a dearth of tree canopy, which again is something that we were dealing with here. So we kind of looked into it saying, hey, can we knit these really cool canopy structures? And of course, hanging big things of yarn in between buildings, not the most fire-safe practice, which I totally understand from an engineering standpoint. But I think when you keep running into these barriers of like, oh, you can't because of the warranty, you can't because of this, you do want to talk to folks who are the decision makers or policy makers or folks who work in engineering at the city, for example, who may know a way to work around it or what is permitted. Instead of giving a blanket, we can't do this, is there a way in? Can we pilot something? If we get the right amount of funding and the right people together, the community has these ideas. We have the person power. We could get together a team of people to knit 100 tree canopies if we wanted, right? We just need the right in, the right permission to do so. And so a lot of it is kind of tiptoeing around or navigating these permissions, trying to just get the right person at the city to tell us, like, how can we go about doing this, right? And there's some very wonderful helpers at the city who do help and point us in the right direction, but it gets tricky, right? It seems like there's always a reason not to do it.
I will add that the city, and give credit to the city where credit is due, they are moving forward with pilot on painting roofs white.
Yay!
And they have been taking the steps to be able to address some of those challenges and make sure that there aren't any problems legally or with warranty. But it's a slow process sometimes. And when you have something like extreme heat waves, you need to also have ways to respond immediately.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely makes sense that there are some barriers to getting things done quickly and efficiently. And it's great that there's been so many innovative solutions that I've actually never heard of to combat this. And I was wondering, like, what are the strengths of collaboration between an academic institution like a university with community members and community organizations?
I have to kind of frame this by saying, like, in order to allow the strengths to present themselves, you need to kind of create a playing field where all knowledge and expertise is valued. You can't kind of create a space where it's like, oh, we're going to bring in researchers and they're the ones with like the actual expertise and the theory, and then community members can like respond to that. Mm-hmm. That is not at all what we are seeking to do. We want to really, I think what really makes the CLEAR project successful is we try and really avoid that hierarchical approach of like what knowledge is valued and that academic research or peer-reviewed knowledge is the actual solutions, and the community can kind of match up with that and make it work, right? We want to create a space where lived and living experience, where indigenous forms of knowledge, community-generated experience, community-generated reports and knowledge, just because it hasn't, you know, passed through peer review or because it's not published on an academic journal does not mean that some of the reports or zines or the artifacts generated in the community are not these deeply resourceful and impactful tools that are already trying to address some of these things as well. And so I think the thing that we've really tried to embody, and I kind of talked about not adding to the research landscape, just kind of making existing research accessible to the community. And by holding these community forums where we're inviting politicians, researchers, community organizers, community members, again, it should not feel like an academic lecture that the university is there to fix things or tell the community how things should be done. We want to be responsive to, again, what is already going on in the community, what are the assets, what are the strengths, what organizations are already doing this work, that if we empower them, if we use the research or the funding that the university has to really empower the work that's already going on, that's the way that we're going to be successful. And so I think really emphasizing the importance that these community organizations, the knowledge they hold, the networks that they have, and the people power that they've already had working on these issues for many, many years, not creating a landscape where that's devalued, and really creating spaces of a conversation and spaces of action where we're really relying on what networks and skills that these community partners have. I really think about there's a project we have right now that's working on the procurement of cooling supplies. The cooling kits I was talking about, unfortunately, did not have the same funding this year as they've had in previous years. And so a lot of organizations were left scrambling a little bit to kind of collect some cooling supplies to best support the needs of their residents or their patrons. There's a wonderful network, and I'm going to give SFU a little bit of props here. We're on the SFU turf. So there's some wonderful folks who work out of SFU's Siri office, which is looking located at 312 Main in the Downtown Eastside communities. That's a community engaged research office, and we need more of those, pretty please. If anybody from other universities are listening, the more community engagement spaces in community, the better. They published something quite recently called the Climate Resilience Roadmap for Nonprofits in the Downtown Eastside. And this is a very tangible, action-focused document that really takes ideas of what does climate justice look like, specific, tailored to the Downtown Eastside, and how can we take tangible action from that instead of just never-ending discussion loops. And so we've been working with folks over there to do different projects. That's kind of where some of the exploration around knitting canopies has gone on. But this summer, especially, they kind of merged their team of partners, which include First United. I mentioned Amanda Burrows. It includes the Portland Hotel Society. It includes Hogan's Alley. For those unfamiliar with Hogan's Alley and the Hogan's Alley Society, it was a historic black neighborhood located quite close to the where the Learning Exchange exists that was destroyed to build the Georgia Viaduct. But there's a wonderful group called the Hogan's Alley Society that is dedicated to both preserving the history, empowering the new generation of black Vancouverites living in and around that area. But they're also taking climate justice very, very close to heart through their work as well. And so this big network of partners working with us at UBC, working with the SFU project, they all kind of like the Avengers. We kind of came together and combined our powers, and they created this like massive procurement network this summer that really looked at, okay, Portland Hotel Society already has this procurement channel. Working Gear is already working with this company that can get us sunscreen and get us water bottles. What if we put together all of our resources, all of our power, all of our spending power, and we were able to kind of maximize the cooling supplies we can get and distribute them all the different organizations? And it looked different for every organization. One was doing peer-led misting stations where they just had community members spraying each other like with like big misting, cooling each other down on hot days. One was actually handing out cooling supplies. But again, it was peers working with that organization who were doing it, not UBC staff members, not SFU faculty. It was the community organizations kind of pooling their resources with the support of UBC and SFU, but really addressing a need, an emergent need around getting these cooling supplies together. And again, we really relied on their networks, the access to cooling supplies that they knew that they could have. We helped with the coordination, but it was really like everybody coming and contributing what they could, their own experiences, their own expertise, and their own networks to really address something that kind of unfortunately came, I won't say it came out of nowhere, but we were very disappointed to find out that the cooling kits were not going to be funded. We said, we're not going to wallow in this. What action can we take? Let's work with this wonderful team of folks from SFU, from UBC, and from all these organizations to make it happen. And it really came together in a good way this summer. And so that's really what it looks like, is relying on everybody's expertise and what knowledge they're bringing to the table, never assuming that you know more about a certain topic than they do, or that, you know, academic is greater than. It's cheesy. It's why the Learning Exchange is called the Learning Exchange. We want to fight against hierarchical or colonial ideas of what knowledge is valued and how knowledge is owned or shared. And I think the Clearer Project is a great example of how we kind of embody that.
Yeah, totally. And talking about accessibility in research, I want to get into as well. I personally study psychology at SFU, and the further into academia and research that I get, the more I realize the amount of just straight up jargon, but also like the barriers to access can greatly impede the potential benefits of research. Like when the methodology is designed by the researchers and isn't in line with the community's needs, we end up with solutions that don't actually solve anything or aren't even acted upon, like you mentioned, which leads me to the question, like, how can we make research more accessible?
So I think you touched on a few different things there. So there's different stages in the research process that can impact how accessible it is. You talked a little bit about the design of the research. Matt has also mentioned a little bit about once the research is out there, how can we make those results accessible? Mm-hmm. So there are a few different ways to approach this question. As Matt said, sort of community engaged research is about starting with community and working with community to hear what their priorities are, to be able to have that conversation and collaboration and make sure that the research questions you're asking actually respond to their needs or can sometimes validate, because while community engaged research and CLEAR can work from a place where all perspectives are valued, one of the perspectives that we have heard is that there are structures in this world that will listen to a peer-reviewed paper to support their own advocacy work. And that's also one of the reasons to bring some of these researchers together, but you want to make sure that that research is actually responding to their needs and is not replicating something that's already happened. So to make it more accessible, you can start by listening and valuing what is out there and what's coming from the people most impacted. And then once you publish, think about how you're communicating those results. So you mentioned jargon. You want to think about not even just jargon, but different ways that people are framing problems and talking about different issues might change across different communities. You also want to think about language. So one thing when we're especially talking about the downtown east side, there are also a number of recent immigrants. It's also, you know, right beside Chinatown. There are a number of different languages spoken in and around the downtown east side. So you want to think also about which languages you are sharing your research results in. Mm. And I'll pass this last bit to Matt, because this is a key initiative of the Learning Exchange about the Making Research Accessible initiative, which is once this work is already published, how are you making it available and evergreen and accessible through language to wider communities?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll talk about the MRAI, Making Research Accessible Initiative. I'll end with a climate angle on this, though. I'll promise I'll get there. I'm going to start with research more broadly. The MRAI has existed for quite some time, I think a decade now, and it really did identify that there was a lot of research that had been done in and with community. A lot of it had been done, you know, very well, but when it came to publication, dissemination, and sharing it back with the community who participated in it, you know, it was either, like, it has been published in an academic journal and is behind a paywall. We are going to go, you know, present it at this conference in Berlin. No community will be there. Yeah. When it came to sharing the information back, it was just kind of like, I published, it's there if you need it. But there was not a lot of consideration about how are we meaningfully giving this back to the community. That was kind of the origin of the MRAI. A few different ways that we really address making research accessible. And this is kind of the MRAI itself. We support community-based research. If there's a community group who's looking to do research, we can connect them with faculty or resources. If there's a faculty member or a student who wants to do research in and with the communities, we're happy to consult with them to kind of talk about what that looks like. One of the main outputs we have is called the Downtown Eastside Research Access Portal. This is developed in collaboration with the UBC Library and some really wonderful folks at the UBC iSchool, which trains all of the wonderful librarians who come out of UBC. It's an online repository. It looks quite similar to the UBC Library or the Circle platform, which we have. That's an online free repository where a lot of students upload their theses, or it's open access publication. So we work really closely with the Circle team, and we reach out to researchers who have published articles specifically about the Downtown Eastside communities working in and with them that are hidden behind paywalls. And we say, hey, congrats on your publication. Very exciting. Nothing we can do about the copywritten version that is currently on said academic journal, but the manuscript before it went to formal publication, the version that before it went to the journal, that we can actually apply for a Creative Commons license for that. We can upload that to Circle, and we can therefore put that for free on the Research Access Portal. And so, yeah, we have a team of student librarians who are working at UBC, reaching out to researchers. Almost all of them say, yes, please put my research for free on the Research Access Portal. And that was kind of the early days of the MRAI. It was just kind of taking things that had cost money before, making them free. Just because research is free does not mean it's accessible. I think Michelle identified some other things that make research inaccessible around jargon. And so we started working with first-year undergraduate students at UBC, something that I wish I had done when I did my undergraduate studies back in Alberta. These first-year undergraduates work directly with one article and one researcher from the Research Access Portal that has been made open access. They get feedback directly from the author, and they develop plain language summaries that de-jargonize the article and make it kind of layman's terms. If somebody doesn't speak English as a first language or just doesn't speak academic, they're able to digest the main contents, the main findings of that article. Not accessible enough, we take it another step further. After the plain language summary is done, the students start working on some kind of interpretation of the data. Primarily, that has been infographics. The students have created infographic visualizations, really simple, nice-looking infographics that we put on the Research Access Portal next to the articles. And so if somebody wants to really quickly digest the contents, they just take a look at the infographic. If you're an individual community member who wants to learn more, you can access it that way. If you're an organization who's writing a report that involves the topic that you're writing about, hey, there's all the stats and data data you need all in one place. It was really embedding levels of accessibility. Those outputs have looked like other things now. We have interpretive websites, videos that are adding on to just the infographics. It's been a really cool ongoing collaboration. It's called the UBC Share Project, Students Harnessing Academic Research for Exchange. I'm happy I remember the acronym.
Yes.
But that is first-year undergrads really learning what does accessible research look like, learning about community-engaged issues. It's a really, really cool project. And so, bringing this back to our wonderful friends at SFU, when they published this climate roadmap that I mentioned earlier, one of the main recommendations, one of the tangible actions was, ideally, the city, the province, health authorities, these folks who are putting out really important, good information about how to stay cool, where cooling centers are, it's really great that it's out there, but a lot of it, again, is not tailored or curated to the needs of the downtown Eastside community. I mentioned the one that said, go, you know, shopping and cool yourself down that way. And so we worked with some folks at Hogan's Alley, we worked with the SFU team, and we worked with this idea of the power of infographics and accessible information. We brought some existing infographics that were made by the City of Vancouver, Fraser Health, Coastal Health, there were some by the government of BC, and we brought them to the residents of Nora Hendricks Place. That's a supportive housing site very close to the Learning Exchange that's maintained by the amazing folks at Hogan's Alley. We spoke with 20 different residents, so it's a modular housing unit, temporary housing, but they're really amazing at what they do. A lot of the residents don't have air conditioning, though, and so they kind of met some of the criteria for not having access to mechanical cooling. And so we brought some infographics that, you know, recommended using AC or what to do when it gets smoky. How do you create a clean air room? But not all the information was super applicable to the downtown Eastside context. And we said, what information on we had two infographics on each topic: indoor wildfire smoke, outdoor staying cool, or identifying signs of heat stroke. And we said, what information is actually meaningful to you? What applies to your lived experience? What has nothing to do with you? This is not helpful information. And we worked with an amazing team of students who interviewed folks in Nora Hendricks Place, synthesized the feedback, took those existing infographics, and kind of created a new one that was really specific to the needs of folks who living in SROs or modular housing don't have access to AC. They may be dealing with, especially these past few weeks, wildfire smoke coming indoors. They may not be able to do a super great job getting airflow through their units. How can we create informational materials that are specific to the needs of Nora Hendricks Place or other housing situations in the downtown Eastside? And so the students all created infographics really aligning with the recommendations from the climate roadmap, saying here's accessible climate information that is, it cuts out all the noise, all the jargon, and all the things that don't apply to your context. Here's information that will help you stay safe. It's in, you know, plain language terms. And the nice thing is we really only started intending it to be for Nora Hendricks Place, but it's now gone to all different organizations through the community. Folks heard about it and they said, we want these infographics as well. So I've been hand delivering it to different organizations around the downtown Eastside, making sure that the information gets out there. But that's, again, it was kind of saying, like, you know, a lot of assumptions have been made by the people who created these infographics. Are they really trying to create a really diverse tool that would meet a lot of folks' needs? How can we hear directly from community members who have that lived experience, who know what strategies they use to stay cool, what information is actually meaningful to them, and let's make something that is by the downtown Eastside, really for the residents here, with a little bit of student power facilitating that work, but recognizing that those folks have the knowledge of what they can do to stay cool in their context. How can we share that knowledge out and not just academic infographics or publications?
Yeah, that's actually awesome. I love the word de-jargonize, first of all. It's very good.
It's harder than it sounds like. When you think you've de-jargonized something, it's like simpler. A lot of the work that the students do is just like even simpler than that. Like keep going, keep trimming out. It's a tricky exercise to de-jargonize something. It sounds quite simple. It sounds like you're taking all the big words out. It's a lot more than that. And it's a great learning. I learned from watching the students engage with the process.
Yeah, totally. And that's just a step in applying it too. So I know there's always like this, not always, but there's often sometimes like a disconnect between theory and then actually applying that to real life and having it be super effective. So yeah, we've talked about theory, we've talked about some applied things. I was wondering more, like, it's more of a thematic question, but I was wondering, what does the term climate equity mean to you both? And building upon that a little bit, just in your name, Clear, I'm curious how the resilience piece ties in.
So climate equity speaks to a number of different issues. So it's not only who is impacted the most from different climate impacts or impacts from climate change, or is it only who is contributing most to climate change. It's more of this piece that Matt has also been talking about, is who also has the skills and the who is empowered to have the capacity to respond to those climate change impacts. And I think that's what CLEAR has really been trying to do, address really those, that last piece and that first piece. So identifying, like, working with the people most impacted by some climate change impacts, including extreme heat and other extreme weather, and how can we empower and provide tools or other resources so that they can mobilize and use the strategies that they already know what to do, and then also teach them some new tricks along the way. So the resilience is a little bit of that. So when people already know how to respond, and are already some of the things that CLEAR did, so those pop-up cooling and heating stations, those came from community. Mm-hmm. That idea came from community, and they said, we need to share these supplies. And they were already doing those things and taking those actions and visiting and checking in on their neighbors, bringing in ice, bringing in water during the heat dome in 2021. CLEAR just came in and said, okay, what would you like to do? What are you already doing? What do you need to be able to do that? And some of that was funding for more resources and more supplies. And so that's also what we've been able to do this year with collaboration with the SFU roadmap. And that resilience piece is about, okay, long term, how do we do this? We've been starting with these immediate actions of handing out materials, but that doesn't actually change. That doesn't bring cooling into their buildings. It doesn't give them housing to have access to cool buildings. It doesn't make them feel welcome in spaces to go window shopping. Mm. And so that resilience piece is that some of those building conversations and building relationships with decision makers, and that is also a long-term action plan. Those also take time to build in those relationships, policy changes, as we mentioned, and we, you know, highlighted that about shade structures. They take time, but that doesn't mean that you can stop taking steps in those directions. You can't lose sight of that vision of, okay, we eventually need to be able to put up a shade structure. We need to keep working on this, of making this easier. And also, what do we do immediately? So that resilience piece is that long-term vision, as well as the immediate responses.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you did a wonderful job of just kind of, like, the resilience is already there. Folks already have really wonderful strategies. Sometimes it feels like the resilience for me, what I'm kind of witnessing is, like, again, like, a lot of these organizations very much are organizations who are working with peers, with residents, with individuals. All of them are very attuned to this and have their own strategies of dealing with it. I think part of it is, number one, their concerns being taken seriously, whether that's by politicians, by academics, by anybody, just making sure that it's understood that, like, yes, we are resilient, but we are also on the front lines of this, and are suffering the effects in a disproportionate way. And, like, that really needs to be recognized in the way that information is communicated and the way that resources are distributed. That comes down to the equity piece. I think also, like, again, recognizing that so many organizations, I really talked about how a lot of the CLEAR partners don't necessarily consider themselves sustainability organizations, but they're doing it because they recognize how important it is to the community, to the folks that they're working with, since they're doing it off of kind of the side of their desk, or they're now allocating budget that they may not necessarily have to making sure that they have the supply. That's where I'm really seeing the resilience come through, is that so many organizations and individuals are embedding this into their day-to-day practice, their budgets, but they don't have the capacity and resources to necessarily do so, but they're still doing it because they have to, because it's necessary, because it's really that we're seeing the impacts right in front of us, you know. And I think, like, it's taking a lot out of understaffed, under-resourced organizations to do this work, and that's where the resilience is coming through, is that they can't be like the Learning Exchange used to be and say, no, not in our scope anymore. They have to be resilient because it's directly impacting everyone that they work with, and, you know, I think that's been really resonant in the work with CLEAR, is witnessing these organizations really go above and beyond, put in hours, put in, you know, developing these peer networks to really address this when it isn't necessarily in the bigger scope of their work, but it's they're very solutions oriented, and this is what needs to be done. And so they're looking for support, networks, organization. That's where we can kind of jump in. But yeah, the resilience is already there, and it just has to be. Climate change needs to be taken seriously. First and foremost.
Yes.
I will add to that resource piece and taking climate change seriously is one thing that we've heard again and again from community partners when they are responding to these climate change impacts, responding to extreme weather. They are purchasing supplies because they are needed. And you mentioned that there's not necessarily budget for it. So that is something that is really important, and that is a long-term vision. And really, it shouldn't be long-term. It should be able to be, you know, addressed fairly immediately when we are in a state of emergency because of some impacts from climate change impacts with the wildfires across BC. Climate change is an emergency that you need to be prepared for, just like these organizations are mandated to have earthquake prepare kits. They should be mandated and have budgetary support to be able to respond to climate change impacts. And so that means that they should be able to have a budget line when they are applying for funding, when they are receiving funding from public organizations, to be able to build in these costs that they are already taking on and that they have to take on. Even cities that are responding to extreme climate impacts cannot pre-order supplies until there is a state of emergency or a heat wave that has been declared, because that is the way the funding structure works. Yeah. And so how can we adapt these larger structures to actually be able to be prepared and mobilize some and take advantage of some lower costs of buying some of these materials, things like water and fans that you need to have in advance to have the resiliency to mitigate, you know, using all these big fancy climate words, to actually be able to respond to the climate change and, you know, not die in a heat wave.
Yeah, no, I like, that was a really, like, that was an aha moment for me. I think it was a community member at one of our forums who said just what you said, was like, the city of Vancouver, UBC, all these organizations have earthquake preparedness kits. You have stockpiles of supplies if and when. We have not had one in our lifetime that has devastated the community, and knock on wood, hopefully we don't have one in our lifetime. But we're hyper prepared for, well, maybe not hyper, we are prepared for the eventuality of if an earthquake happens, we have water, we have food, we have like shelter, we have all these supplies ready. When it comes to climate change, we're actually defunding or taking away funding from something that we are directly seeing the impacts of on a day-to-day basis every summer now. We don't have earthquakes every day in the summer. We sure are having a lot of 30 degree days though. And so the idea that we do have earthquake kits for something that may or may not ever happen, but we don't have the funding for climate kits for something that we're directly seeing the impacts of. Like when somebody said that, I was like, I had never thought of it that way. And that is bang on how we're applying these resources, what we're putting that funding to. Why would we not put the same attention to something that is actually impacting us day to day now? I had never thought of it that way. And I can't remember who it was that said it, but I was like, bang on. Like, how have I never considered it like that? But it's true. Like, what are the priorities? Why are we moving funding away from climate supplies? It seems baffling. I'm sure the community is baffled. We're all baffled by it, right? Yeah.
Totally. Thank you for bringing that comparison up. I've never thought about it that way either. And that is quite pertinent because, like, it is so frustrating that these things are not being addressed right now and also prevented, because, like, we can still do things to help, yeah, like you said, like, mitigate this issue. And we are coming to the top of the hour right now, so I just wanted to ask one final question. If you can just sum it up in a minute or two, a few minutes. Like, what are some current projects that y'all want to highlight at CLEAR or future projects?
So Matt did raise a few of the projects that the CLEAR has been working on. The infographics is a big one. This joint procurement, so being able to buy these supplies together with a number of different organizations, that has been a big focus of this summer in particular, to be able to respond immediately to extreme heat. And we are working with CLEAR partners to continue to have those long-term conversations, because we really want to find, for example, a solution to having immediate shade, to increasing green spaces and access to cooling spaces outside for those folks who also can't access cooling inside their buildings. or maybe not have a building. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things and the conversations that we've been having.
Yeah, the summer's really been looking at the procurement, like filling the gap that was created by the defunding of the cooling kits. So a lot of our efforts have gone towards that. Not a lot of room for other things right now. When the fall wraps up, we're going to kind of take a look at the roadmap we've identified. We did a little bit of the communications piece. We did some of the procurement piece. There's a lot of other ideas in there that we want to kind of, we're doing some visioning with some community partners in September, saying what else can we do now that the heat has started, hopefully by September it's alleviating, maybe not this year. What else can we do? I do think this shade structure one is a big one that we will need quite a few minds on, both academic, community. We need some engineers to consult with maybe. But I think a big focus is going to be looking at that roadmap and saying what other tangible solutions exist in here. And I think there's always new. The wonderful thing is, as folks learn about CLEAR, whether they're students, researchers, community, they're like, how can I get involved with this? I want to contribute to this because I see the value of really connecting all these resources together. And so I think staying open to opportunities, sometimes just the right person pops up. I think when we got connected to Liv Yoon, it was like, oh my gosh, this is some really amazing research that I think if we find ways to really share this out with community, there are a lot of people be on board with this. And so identifying those emerging researchers who are contributing to the dearth of climate research as it relates to the downtown Eastside communities, finding ways to connect them with on the ground movements, staying open to possibility. I will also mention
I do need to interject. Oh. We have like 50 seconds left.
Municipal election, so we're waiting to see what happens with that. So stay tuned, because that could change things a lot.
Lose sight of communities.
Yeah. Totally.
Exactly.
Thank you, Matt and Michelle, so much for joining me on this episode of Super Summer Programming. This is CJSF 90.1 FM. Up next is Typically Tuesday, so stay tuned for that. And yeah, I'll be here on Friday as well for another episode. So see you then. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to our Super Summer Programming.
Catch us next Friday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m.
And until then, stay super chill.